You've landed inside Launch Street, the Business Innovation Podcast, where we interview top innovators out there shaking things up so you can innovate, differentiate, and get further faster. Since you're here, we know you're the type of person that recognizes the importance of unlocking your innovation advantage so you can compete and win. And now, your host, the person that has worked with leading companies like Disney, Procter & Gamble, Arrow Electronics, the U.S. Army Research Labs, and Red Robin on upping their innovation advantage, Tamara Gontor.
What's up, Launch Streeters? Tamara here, your host and innovation enabler. Super excited for today's interview. Actually, I'm excited for all of them because I think we have pretty amazing guests. And I think they share a ton with me and with you, the community. So I hope you're getting as much out of these podcasts as I am. In fact, do me a favor. If you are, will you go to iTunes or Stitcher, wherever you listen, and leave us a review? I would love to see what you're getting out of our podcast. And a review is the best way to do it and to let other people like you know that we're out there and a resource for them. So I hope you'll do that for me. I would be so appreciative. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, on to today's interview. So today I interview Shema Hyder. Now, she's got kind of an interesting background. She is a visionary strategist for the digital age, web TV personality, best-selling author. Her latest venture, Made.design, is an architectural design studio that integrates marketing, technology, and physical environments to help brands connect with modern-day consumers. Super interesting, right? Well, I brought her on because I wanted to talk about the next frontier in marketing, in culture, because let's face it, your environment, your office space has a huge impact on the tone, the energy within for yourself, with your team inside the organization. She's also the author of The Zen of Social Media Marketing and Momentum, How to Propel Your Marketing and Transform Your Brand in the Digital Age. We talk about something called the empowered office and about the future of workplace design. This is a little bit different, but it has, like I said, such an impact on innovation. I think, you know this in your own world. It's when you're in a sitting down and trying to be innovative and you're in an environment that feels stifling and boring and stiff, it's hard. But if you've got an environment that fosters innovation and collaboration and new perspectives, it becomes a lot easier. All right, let's dig in. Shema, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm very much looking forward to our conversation.
Thank you so much for having me. Pleasure to be here.
Well, let's have our audience get to know you. What's one thing people would be surprised to learn about you?
That I am a very fast reader. And I don't mean like just speed reading. I just mean I can read really, really quickly. Probably explains why I aced the verbal part of my SAT.
It does come in handy.
I'm not going to go into my math score because that was embarrassingly bad, but yes.
So do you use that skill? Like, do you read a lot of business books fast or online, or how do you leverage that skill now?
I do. I mean, it's great because I'm able to polish off, you know, a book a week. And that means not obviously in one sitting, you know, whenever I have time on a plane or things like that. So I think in that way, it's very helpful just because I can digest information so quickly. Or if we have a client brief, I'm able to, you know, take that information and sort of process that rather quickly as well.
I'm not going to lie, I'm a little jelly because I am the slowest reader ever. And it just takes me forever to read. And, you know, like I'll be reading something with someone on a screen and they're scrolling already to get to the next part. And I'm like, wait, I'm not done. Hold on.
Yeah. You know, there's something we said about reading for pleasure, right? Versus reading for efficiency.
Yeah.
And so, and since sometimes I have a hard time just even slowing down enough to be able to say, oh, okay, like, look at this great, you know, because I'm reading it just so quickly to get the information versus I think sort of lingering, which I can do that with certain books. It actually takes effort to slow down than it does to speed up. Isn't that weird?
You know, it's funny though, because I think that's a little bit of an analogy for your life. So let's dig in a little bit, because you keep starting things before everybody else realizes
it's the right thing to do, like before it's the trend, right? So you started Marketing Zen to offer social media service before most people even knew what social media was. Now you've launched Made.Design to help brands reach their customers with physical spaces and experiences. I want to dig into a few questions here. One is, how do you identify these things as the next wave that you should really be paying attention to? Let's start there, actually. Like, how do you do that?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I think I'm in a really privileged position, right? In that so much comes to me at this point in my career, in that people, you know, I get a lot of invest in this opportunity. So a lot of the things that before they take off, I often get sort of a sneak peek, or, you know, being part of the media and some of the things that I do with, like, you know, being on TV and having columns, you know, with Inc. and Forbes and so forth. A lot of those things will come to me. And so it's nice when you're in that position, right? Because you get to sort of see, like, from a different vantage point and an earlier perspective. I will say I often also, I do a lot of my own research. I read a lot, which we've done.
Quickly, apparently.
Quickly and substantially. So I think that certainly helps. Also, being an academic at heart, because I almost became a professor and I really enjoy academia, I keep up a lot in that realm of what's being published, what's being shared. And then from a more sort of practical, you know, how do you trend spot? I think it's funny, just things that we look at, like I always look at what kids are using, because it's just a matter of time before everyone else, you know, you think of Snapchat or Instagram. I think so many things that start there become more mainstream for us.
So
right?
let's talk a little bit then about the whole kind of physical spaces and experiences, and that being the new marketing frontier, especially because I think most of the conversation, not most, but a lot of the conversation is still around online. So how does this physical spaces and experiences become that frontier? Talk to us about that.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because when I started experiential design, sort of, you know, expanded our offerings for that, people said, isn't that funny? Like, you're taking a step back because you're always been so digital and now you're doing the traditional thing. And I always laugh and I'm like, no, you know what? Things are coming full circle. And I've always said that I'm not, you know, even when I started, people always want to be or, and I'm such an and person, like naturally, I think that's just my personality. Because what I mean by that is people think, oh, okay, so if you're pro digital, you're not pro traditional. Or you're anti-traditional. And I've always said, no, absolutely not. I think there will always be room for everything. You know, it's just more splintered in how we reach our audiences and the things that we continuously do. So what traditional even looks like is changing. And I've said that, right? I think smartphones are traditional now. Like it's
right. Yeah. They quickly became traditional.
What is the status quo, right? Whatever is the status quo is so where billboards might be traditional, but they're more historic traditional, right? That sort of caveat. So I think with experiential, it's about that full customer cycle. Or I think the good way to look at this would be, how do you create less friction for doing business with you? And from starting to finish, how do you take that friction away? And part of that is experience. It's not just what you do to get someone. It's not, you know, marketing is not a band-aid. A lot of times it's seen as a band-aid for a bullet hole problem, which is really, really not a healthy way to look at it. So it's about approaching that from a different perspective.
I want to dig into the friction part of it, because I do think a lot of businesses, large and small, have a lot more friction than they even realize for doing business with them. I mean, we've even just started to assess our own stuff to say, wait a minute, where are we creating friction for our customers? But will you walk us through maybe an example of either someone that you think is killing it out in the marketplace, or that you've had a hand in, they're one of your clients, and how you've reduced friction, and whether that's online or real life, or even both, to your point, because it's not either or.
Yeah, so you know, one of my clients that I'm actually really, really love, and I'm a client, I'm a customer of theirs, where their vendors, like their partners, I just really love these guys, is Chase Business. Right? We do a lot with Chase Business. And the reason that they're so awesome is because they understand that they're not in the business of banking. They understand that they're in the business of helping other businesses grow. And they do that through banking. And that is a completely different approach, right? Than it would be to say, oh, we're a bank, this is what we stand for. And one of the things that we've done with them is they have these amazing business conferences for their customers. And they're curating information. It's not, you know, these are not banking conferences. These are how to grow your business, how to grow, you know, whatever level it is, how to take your business to the next level. And they, you know, we're Zen Media. We go in and we often host these like social media, genius bars, or like helping their customers understand digital marketing better, or you know, what's the role video plays? Where's Instagram going? How do I look at my Facebook analytics? Stuff like that. And I think that's important. I think being able to look at what do your customers need, and you're right. And so before you even start to think about how do you reduce friction, you're almost thinking about what is it that they're trying to accomplish. So you see yourself more as a as leverage for them, right? Versus this is what we offer and this is your end goal, because banking is not their end goal. Building a business is their end goal, and banking just happens to be a crucial piece of that.
So how do they then on a day-to-day basis, I mean, is there a way that they do it, just to use them as an example? I actually bank with them and I've had a great experience. But how do they do that on a day-to-day basis in a way that maybe the other banking, their competition, I guess, doesn't?
Yeah, I mean, in so many ways, right? But I think these events that they do are such, they're so awesome, because it is, you know, and they have them in cities all over the U.S., and I love that, because it is very much about that focus on business. Or even you look at how many, you know, webinars they do, or how much digital content they produce. It really is staggering.
Yeah.
And it's all this content for their business customers to grow their business. They do, you know, it's on HR and marketing and finance. And it's not about like, hey, here's the right, you know, they're not pitching you. They understand that if they help a business grow, then of course that inevitably helps them grow, right? It's such a win-win.
You know, it's interesting you say that. There's kind of two things coming to mind, but one is, I think it was Squarespace. Someone was talking about why they're so successful as a web platform. And their comment was they're successful because they help other people make money, not because they deliver an easy web service. Yes, that's part of it. Like, that's the product, right? But mm-hmm. but really, at the end of the day, what they're in the business of is creating a larger economy for entrepreneurs, which they've done. And it kind of goes back to what you said in the beginning, which is the banking's not the business Chase is in, it's growing your business, which is an interesting thought around the product you offer is not your business. Do you see that as kind of a key to understanding minimizing friction and, you know, creating those good experiences about really understanding what business you're in and then what products or services you deliver?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's important. And the thing is, it's also an evolution. It's not always static, right? The things you sometimes start with evolve, and that's fine. And that's why I think it's about being agile too, and making sure that you're not so stuck in your ways that you can't see an opportunity and take advantage of it.
So you had said something, I'm switching gears a little bit, but in a LinkedIn article, Future of Workplace Design, which kind of caught my attention. You talked about how today's workspaces need to evolve to meet today's changing workforce. I want to talk a little bit about that, because I think with organizations that are successful, it's because they recognize that their people come first along with their customers. It's not, you know, customer first, employees, screw them. Will you talk a little bit more about that? Because I think a lot of people are out there in cubicle land thinking, well, I could use some help here. What about my space?
Yeah, you know, so I think what's really interesting about the office spaces is that we've gone through such changes. You look at traditional spaces, and they were all about the cubicles and, you know, the corner office and certain markers of prestige, which of course today is like more what people find online than anything, you know, before they've even seen whatever, wherever you are. And that, so in a way, that sort of, I think, lost some of that sparkle, or like the, you know, the level of importance that it once carried, right? It's not that, like, I think that the workplace is a symbol of that has changed. It's more, I think it is about more sort of a comfortable place where you work at, and it's efficient and productive, and you know, feels like a good environment and so forth. So we went from this sort of cubicle land to all open, which Google sort of really spearheaded that movement, in that everything's open. Everyone can see everybody. Everyone works out in the open. There's no there's nowhere to hide, right?
Yeah, I don't know how I feel about that personally. We'll dig right. more into it, but I'm not so productive in those environments.
And you know what? A lot of people aren't. So there's this extensive, like, So we went from like one size fits all to another one size fits all, and we find out that neither size fits all. And so today what we're seeing is much more the empowered office and the empowered design. And that's a crucial change, because that focuses much more on there's times where you want to be able to work in a silo, where you need to be able to put your head down. You don't want the distractions. You're having a conversation, whatever it may be, right? It is, you require privacy for that productivity. Then there's times where you're like, you need that creative space to throw ideas around. You're brainstorming and you're just in a different place in your head. What you need, right, has different requirements. And so I think that's really important, is to be able to note that and be able to leverage that. And so what we're seeing now is a mix of spaces. And, you know, it also really depends on the company. What are your values? Who are you trying to attract? What's the kind of ethos that you want to project to? You know, an office with a lot of investment bankers who are working at a certain level is going to look different than a creative agency and what their needs are. And so it has to take into account what kind of work is being done there as well.
So I just want to make sure I'm clear, not being assumptive, because I love the concept of what you're saying about create a work environment that fits the type of work, really, and the people that needs to, the work that needs to get done and the people who are there. Is an empowered office really about taking that approach to the office space versus the, like, here's the layout, now all the people fit into that layout?
Yeah, it very much is. It very much is. It's so much about giving empowering people, right? Empowering people to do their best work, when they do it, where they do it, how they do it.
Mm. How do you think the physical environment impacts your ability to innovate, you know, be productive at work?
It's huge. I mean, now the good thing is we have so much research on this, right, that shows how productivity is impacted by our environment, and we find staggeringly so. Which, if you talk to any architect, they're like, "We've been saying this all along."
Yeah, right.
Know this.
Hello.
We know that environment has an impact. We just seem to sort of sometimes downplay that, or think certain things matter more than others, like the view. when yes and no, the view matters, but so much more matters what's happening within those walls, or again, how that space is structured, and how are you? So I think part of that, I would say, a key term is facilitation. How are you facilitating the needs best of, you know, of your base? The other thing we do a lot of is employee, marketing, employee branding, right? Recruitment. And so that's the other side. When you're marketing to get customers, you're also marketing to get good team members and be able to build that base. One of the things that we find is often people say, how do I get more people interested in working with us? And sometimes that answer, and the answer is never a ping pong table in the kitchen.
It's funny you say that. I was just thinking that. To me, that's one of the big misses. A lot of organizations do not. I'm not against ping pong. It's fine as a kind of sport. But the idea that in a common space is going to solve your collaboration problem or create collaboration where none exists just doesn't – I don't know. It's, to your point earlier about a Band-Aid, that seems like the biggest Band-Aid ever.
Oh, sure. And it's easy, you know, and it makes it fixes the, okay, we want to be cool. Well, check.
Right.
Okay, ping pong. Right, we're cool now. Okay. But so really thinking about that broader and be like, what is going to actually make this an attractive place for people to work? And a lot of that, you know, culturally and such is reflected through the space. And now we see, you know, we've seen the Internet of Things obviously come to a rise, and we look at Alexa Home. I mean, I'm very excited about voice. But I think that'll play even a bigger role in the modern day office than it does, you know, in homes. We will think about walking into a conference room and say, you know, Alexa, pull up these reports, or Alexa, dim the lights, or, you know, video call, you know, the China team office.
Are they, just out of curiosity, maybe this is my naive question, is that being used now, or is that where you think it's headed?
Oh, I think it's being used now. It's just being done in such small doses, and it's being done where, you know, an office might use that. But what I'm talking about is where it becomes a lot more mainstream.
So I have to ask, because you totally, Shema, you totally just did it. You pulled out this tiny little dot of information and were like, I can see this being the next big thing. I'm just curious from a process or maybe a thought, the way you think perspective, because I love our launch readers out there who are all, you know, they're innovators, they're working to be better innovators. What are you looking for when you look at something and think to yourself, that's going to get bigger? What's your thought process there? How do you think about those things? I know that's hard to unpack, but as best you can.
Yeah, that's funny. I will say that I think everyone has gifts, right? And I will say that it's hard to unpack that because some of that, somehow that feels a little more innate to me. Like, it's more like I just know.
Yeah.
Whereas like certain things I absolutely suck at, which is if you ask me like 2 + 2 and it takes me a good 30 seconds to respond, which is shamefully sad. But I will say, I think part of this is small bets. And what I mean by this, and I'm a big fan of this concept, is just being curious and kind of following these trails to say, is there something here, right? Oftentimes when we see big trends that happen, we're so shocked by the outcome of something, it's not that the outcome is shocking, it's that our process was wrong to get there. For example, who wins a presidential election and everyone's shocked, like, oh my God, never expected them to win. No, it's not that that outcome was so shocking as the way we were thinking about what was going to be, right? Which is why, so I think that's funny, is that you have to look at patterns. And I do. I look at patterns. I look at what's changing. And I'm just very curious by nature. So I think a combination of sort of curiosity and researching. And there's lots of things that I think, you know, that I feel like I go down the rabbit hole. And I'm like, oh, this isn't going to have a future. And it does. Like, I'll give you a good example. I thought that, you know, podcasting would just evolve into video.
Right. Instead of being its own big thing.
Yes. Instead of being its own big thing. Because I saw it as an evolution. I was like, yeah, podcasting is really hot. And I think it's just going to all evolve into video. Huh. And, you know, the funny thing is I'm like, oh boy, was I wrong in that podcasting didn't just evolve into video. I wasn't wrong in that video would be a really big thing. And that I've been saying this from like screaming this from the rooftops, right? Now you look at voice. And so same thing. I'm like, I'm really curious about where voice is going, where AI is going, where this is heading. And if you look at the numbers already, these are just early numbers. The thing, most people don't catch the stuff until it's the majority.
Yeah.
What I look at is 1 in 5 mobile searches right now are done through voice.
Oh, wow.
That tells me something. And yeah, right? So if you look at stuff like that, that's such a game changer. And I think you can sort of trend spot in that way.
You know, it's funny that you say that because I have a 13-year-old. I have a 13-year-old, 9-year-old. And my 13-year-old will just ask Siri, right? Just that's how he searches everything. And if he, for whatever reason, Siri is not behaving because he has one of my old iPhones, he just stops. he just done. And I'm like, wait, text it in, like type it in. And he's like, no, why would I do that? Like it would never occur to him to do it that way. But it never really occurred to me to think about, wow, that if he's doing that, right, other kids are doing that, probably some adults too. What a fascinating shift in behavior.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is. And so I think we continue more on that. I mean, I do think, you know, it's funny because as we get inundated with information, we want more information at our fingertips and we want it curated better and we want it, you know.
Right. We want the right information right away.
Yes, exactly.
But I want to go back to what you said about the election and not in any way to get political, but to your point about really all the cues were there. That's where the direction of the election was headed and Trump was going to win. But a big part of this country woke up stunned, right, that it happened. And I think part of what I heard you say in your example and your conversation was that we've got to be careful not to put our blinders on about how we perceive things and just be open to what's really happening, because that's how you start to see the patterns and the trends. I think when we put it through our filter, that's our bias, right? And oftentimes that's unconscious, but when we put it through our filter, we misinterpret information.
Oh, absolutely. And so part of this is being able to get distance on things, right? Just because of your personal preference doesn't match it. And the funny thing is, and this is, I guess, another fact I could have shared about myself. So fitting it that I shared at this point, right? is that I am not a very social person. People think that people just assume because I am, you know, I love technology and I love social media. And I do. I generally do. But you will find that I am not very, I'm a very private person. I don't share my public, you know, my personal life very publicly. I share things that I think are valuable to my audience. And I think, you know, and it's funny because in that way it is, you know, I really have to look at things and say, just because I would never do this doesn't mean that people aren't going to love this. Like Snapchat. Snapchat was a great example. I'm not personally on Snapchat. We use it for clients. I've done Snapchat takeovers. I think it's a great platform. I think it's great for, especially when you're trying to reach younger audiences. But if you had said, you know, would you snap like your life? And I'd be like, no, I'm not gonna do that. But you have to, again, step back and say, I am not everybody, right? And it may, and it's, it, for us at the end of the day, does this help our clients get reach, visibility, whatnot? So I do think it's about sort of distancing and stepping away and saying, okay, it may not be for me, but does that mean that it's not, you know, is that's where things aren't, where they aren't going?
I had a mentor of mine who's a professor of advertising in Boulder, Colorado, which is very bubble, right? Like if you live in Boulder, it's the bubble. It's a very, very secluded. And one of the things he was struggling with is his students would come in and they'd say, you know, he's trying to teach them mass marketing, basically. And they'd say, well, I don't understand why anyone would shop at Walmart. I mean, why wouldn't you just go to Whole Foods? Why wouldn't you spend that money on fresh strawberries instead of, you know, frozen whatever? Because they just had no concept of, if it's not the way I live, that doesn't mean that somebody else doesn't live that way for a reason. So it just, they had such a hard time grasping that. So we created this whole thing where they, his students would go to Walmart. They had to talk to people about what was in their cart. It was so game changing for one kid. He actually joined the Peace Corps, one of these programs, and went and like lived in Guatemala or something. I mean, it was incredible. But it's amazing how easy it is, to your point about, well, if it doesn't fit into my life, it obviously can't fit into anybody else's life.
Yeah. I mean, think about sort of, you know, again, going back to the election, politics aside, right?
Yeah.
What was so shocking, like so many people were like, well, this isn't me, right? Who would agree? Like, what do you, but you find that the world is a much bigger place than your world.
Right? Yeah.
And when it comes to marketing and all of this, it's same thing, you know, for me, like, funny thing is, you know, I can work from almost anywhere. I can work off of a plane. I can work off of my smartphone. And starting a company, you know, to think that that's how all my employees would work was just ludicrous. Like, you know, not everybody works that way. Some people like the option of going into the office and being able to sit down and work. And so I think it's so easy to think, like, we think about diversity, but oftentimes it's so shortchanged because we think about gender or you know, geography. We don't think about diversity in thought and diversity in perspective and diversity in experience. And I feel like that's really true diversity. And honestly, because it's more complicated, it requires more thought.
Yeah. And I think it also requires, and I'd love to hear your perspective on this, an openness to hear debate and be open to somebody else's opinion, perspective, and maybe even now and again, change yours.
Yes. And it takes a certain mindset, right, to be open. And for me, like, I'm such a curious person. I know what works for me, but at the same time, I believe that identity is a changing thing. It's an evolution. Like, I'm a big fan of progress and evolution and change. And I embrace it. You know, not everything's for me, but I love seeing what's working and tinkering with things. And in that way, I'm very much sort of a researcher and can have that objective view on things.
You know, it's interesting. I know it probably launch treaters out there are going, this is amazing. And it feels like a little bit of a tangent. But the reality is, I think what Shema's talking about is exactly what you need to understand in your business too, of not what works for you, even if you're the one that invented the product or managed the product or service, whatever, but what works for your customer and how do you create experiences from start to finish, online, offline, reduce friction as you were talking about, that actually match your customer's needs versus coming at it from our perspective. I think that's where a lot of us get it wrong. I mean, I know as an entrepreneur, I do, because I get so close to my baby that I sometimes forget to stop and go, okay, no. For the people who's using this, what do they need and want? And how can I be open to seeing that?
Yeah, I think that's so important. You know, and one of the things that I talk about in my latest book, Momentum, is this idea of the customer-based philosophy, right? Or customer-focused. And so many times people think it's about, oh, the customer's always right, or you've got to put your clients first. And it's not. That's not even what I mean. What I'm really talking about is, for the longest time, brands have always asked the question, you know, what do we stand for? What's our brand? What's our flag? What do we wave? But the question that people really should be asking, that businesses, marketers, leaders in positions of authority should be asking and responsibility, is, what does doing business with us allow our customers to say about their personal brand? How can we become a vehicle to let them express themselves better, to be able to use that platform?
So I want to dig into your book for a second. Before we do that and run out of time, where can people go to learn more and connect with you?
Yeah, absolutely. You can find, there's so much content if you're interested in marketing and business technology on zenmedia.com. You're also welcome to go to ShemaHyder.com and connect with me on LinkedIn, Twitter, Instagram, you know, choose your poison.
But not Snapchat.
But no, not on Snapchat. Not on Snapchat.
I'm not either. I love it. It's just not for me. I want to ask you a couple questions kind of to close on about your book, Momentum. Is that the name of it, right? Because I don't know that I knew that before we talked. So I'm glad you brought it up. And we'll make sure to put a link in the show notes.
Thank you.
Give me a couple key pieces of advice from the book that you think launch readers should know.
Yeah. So one of the things we hit on, right, this idea of customer focus, really putting the identity of your customer first. And what does that look like? And what does that mean? The other thing I would say, I talk a lot about curation and how important that is. And Launch Street is actually a great, so it's very meta to talk about this in this way because it's such a great example. And it's very much about being a filter. So as we need information, we talk about voice and some of these things, we also are inundated with information. What we need more than ever is something that takes data and turns it into wisdom, right?
Right,
that's our AI is so exciting. But this is why human beings will never go out of business because it's the ultimate filter opportunity. So people listening to this right now in the audience who are listening to Launch Street, think about how Launch Street represents that, represents the curation of bringing sources that people might find valuable, that the audience might find valuable, and serves as a curator. And then think about how you can do that for your business. How can you be that filter for your customer base, right? B2B or B2C. The thing about Momentum is, you know, it's amazing. The books that I've written, Zen of Social Media Marketing and Momentum, I'm always amazed that people will come back and say they've applied these principles across the board. Like I've heard from, this is true stories. I've heard from a preacher who used it to increase his congregation numbers. And I've heard it from a lovely strip club owner named Dolly, who
well, there you go. Two extremes.
Her patronage, right? You know, I mean, so these principles work. I mean, how you use them are really up to you and what you apply them for. But the idea of Momentum is really this: the idea of these sort of five principles that are help provide this guiding framework for how you do business and how you grow your business and your brand in the digital age.
Can you just say without going into depth, because we want people to read the book, obviously, but say what those five principles are so we just have an idea of the foundation?
Yeah, absolutely. The first is the customer focus that we touched on. The second is agility through analytics, you know, why numbers matter, which numbers to look at, just low-hanging fruit. So not talking like big data, right? But almost like small data, the things that are important that you might miss. Then integration, we've touched on that a little bit, how you know, everything needs to play together, the traditional, the digital, what is that seamless, frictionless experience look like? How do you create that? Then curation, talking about, you know, what some great case studies in the book about how companies are doing this right, how they're really embodying this. And the last is cross-pollination. How do you take advantage of the things that are available to you, but you may have siloed or put aside? Like, a lot of times people think, oh, these are my vendors, these are my employees, these are my customers. But what if there's overlap? What if there's more than one way to use any of your groups for advocacy, for, you know, greater distribution of content, whatever it may be?
Just to make sure, because I'm like a little bit gaped mouth over here, like, huh, let me think about that for a second. When you say talk about using them differently, are you thinking of like, how do you think of your employees as your best brand advocates too? Or how do you think of your customers as your best market research?
Absolutely. You know, I'll give you one very quick example. One of our clients that we were creating, they created this content strategy. We were executing on all this amazing content marketing for them. It was a B2B company. And what was happening was they were creating so much, but it's like, how do we get more traction? And one of the things we started realizing was that even the internal team didn't know everything that was happening, right? Like even the employees didn't know. And so we created an internal newsletter that went out to the team that had pre-made LinkedIn updates and tweets and so forth that they could simply copy, paste, and share and know kind of what was already being created on their behalf and representing their company. And that alone increased traffic by 30%. So really wow. Low-hanging fruit on how to leverage some, you know, an asset you already have.
Do you find that with a lot of your clients that there's a lot of low-hanging fruit that they're missing? Not obviously because they're not smart. They obviously are, but they're, you know, everybody has a million things on their plate in a day. But do you find that that's often the case?
Absolutely. Absolutely. One of the first things we do with any of our clients is sort of this kind of deep dive, you know, a playbook. And we look at these things and we look at, okay, what are all the things that you already have in place that you're just not leveraging fully?
You know, part of the reason I ask is because I think with innovation, and I'm sure you see it in your space too, I find that the first comment potential clients say to me is, like, we need something new, we need blue skies, we need, like, to disrupt. And that's true, but I often find that there's some idea in someone's head in their organization or on an old PowerPoint deck somewhere, some nugget in their closets, that if we pulled that out and just tweaked it a little bit, would actually be the most disruptive thing they could do. And they just didn't know it was right in front of them.
Yeah, you know, disruption can often be evolutionary. It doesn't have to be revolutionary. And I think that's the mistake a lot of people make, is they think it's got to be this, like, bam. And it doesn't. A lot of times it's those little shifts that make such a big difference.
I couldn't agree with you more. And I won't go into the long story except to say it was a portable food, like a bar, basically. Mm-hmm. But the idea when it was first presented, the timing wasn't right. It was ahead of its time, actually. And then 5 years later, when we reintroduced it, we changed one little thing in the language and it became a game changer for the business. But it needed that shift in branding to be able to survive. Had we kept it the way it was, it wouldn't have. So to your point, I think you're 100% right. Sometimes those little tweaks make the biggest difference.
Yeah, absolutely.
Shema, thank you so much for coming by. This was absolutely insightful. We'll make sure to put a link to your book and everywhere else in the show notes, but I appreciate your insights.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to be here.
All right, before you go, what did you think? More importantly, what's the one action you're going to take after listening to Shema talk about all the different things we talked about in the new frontiers of marketing and workplace design and collaboration? I'm definitely going to think about how our office is designed and if it really fosters collaboration, or really we're just set up for a bunch of individuals that hopefully bump into each other during the day. I hope you'll do the same. Super cool having her on. Great insights. More to come. Tamara out.
Thanks for hanging with us on Inside Launch Street. If you know someone that is truly ready to unlock their innovation advantage, have them join you on Launch Street. Discover your innovation advantage. Build a team of high-performing innovators and ignite ideas and solutions that create massive impact. GOTO, launchstreet.com. Remember, innovators, if you don't take the leap, somebody else will.